I see. The path that I have chosen now has led me to a wall. And with each passing day, I feel a little more like something here was lost. It rises now before me, a dark and silent barrier between all I am and all that I would ever want to be. It's just a travesty, towering, marking off the boundaries my spirit would erase. To pass beyond is what I seek. I fear that I may be too weak, and those of you who've seen it too, to glimpse the other side. The promised land is waiting, like a maiden that is soon to be a bride. The moment is a masterpiece, the weight of endless visions in the air.
Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly call. Today is Monday, July 17, 2023. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. If you're listening live over a radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on our weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions at nationallibertyalliance.org. Please find support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of the website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save our republic. You can also support us by purchasing the books Government by Consent and Court Access and the Common Law, also found on the right-hand side of our website. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on the donation tab on the top right-hand side of the website. Okay, we're going to pick up where we left off last week in our scripture reading. We're in the book of Hebrews. Last week we read chapter 5. Hang on a second, let me see if I can get this open. Here it goes. This week we'll be reading Hebrews chapter 6, read by Alexander Scorby.
Chapter 6. Therefore, leaving the principles of the doctrine of Christ, let us go on unto perfection, not laying again the foundation of repentance from dead works and of faith toward God, of the doctrine of baptisms and of laying on of hands and of resurrection of the dead and of eternal judgment. And this will we do, if God permit. For it is impossible for those who were once enlightened and have tasted of the heavenly gift and were made partakers of the Holy Ghost and have tasted the good word of God and the powers of the world to come, if they shall fall away, to renew them again unto repentance, seeing they crucify to themselves the Son of God afresh, and put him to an open shame. For the earth which drinketh in the rain that cometh oft upon it, and bringeth forth herbs meet for them by whom it is dressed, receiveth blessing from God. But that which beareth thorns and briars is rejected, and is nigh unto cursing, whose end is to be burned. But, beloved, we are persuaded better things of you, and things that accompany salvation, though we thus speak. For God is not unrighteous to forget your work and labor of love, which ye have showed toward his name, in that ye have ministered to the saints, and do minister. And we desire that every one of you do show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope unto the end, that ye be not slothful, but followers of them who through faith and patience inherit the promises. For when God made promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no greater, he sware by himself, saying, surely, blessing I will bless thee, and multiplying I will multiply thee. And so, after he had patiently endured, he obtained the promise. For men verily swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation is to them an end of all strife. Wherein God, willing more abundantly to show unto the heirs of promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath, that by two immutable things, in which it was impossible for God to lie, we might have a strong consolation, who have fled for refuge to lay hold upon the hope set before us, which hope we have as an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, and which entereth into that within the veil, whither the forerunner is for us entered, even Jesus, made an high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek.
Okay, Jan, do we have any questions or any announcements to be made?
Well, we only have two questions tonight. The first question is, with the IRS cases you have recently been involved with, are you noticing people receiving fewer and fewer correspondence or threats from the IRS?
I don't understand the question. I don't know. I'm not sure what the question was. I mean,
okay.
People receiving fewer
threats or correspondence from the IRS. In other words, are they as pushy as they were before?
Well, I don't know. They haven't pushed me much anymore for quite some time, but that doesn't mean they're not pushing other people, so I have no clue on what's going on with other people. This coming, next Saturday coming up, we're going to be sharing the IRS case, and I think we have a real powerful way on how to deal with them. So anybody that's in the course will be able to see that all that information. So I don't know what else to say on that.
Okay. It is said that we should request our damages in Morgan silver dollars. Can you direct us to any website showing that you or someone else has had requested such and were awarded such in the manner as you have explained?
Well, that's what I suggest. That's what I go for, but I've never been rewarded that. It's something that we've been doing. Well, I've been doing anyway, maybe for the past year or two, any papers that I have written. Mostly, a lot of cases, of course, get thrown out. I've been thrown out numerous times in court, but I do think we finally found a way to get around that, but we'll see what happens. And again, we're going to be sharing that particular case, which could be used with any case. It doesn't have to necessarily be a case against the IRS. you know, the framework of the case and how we're proceeding and how we're framing the case can be done with any kind of a situation, especially when you're dealing with government agencies, but also with corporations or anyone else, depending, again, upon, you know, what the case is about. And again, if you're up against the status quo, because if you're up against the status quo, they're going to do everything they can to throw you out under Rule 12. That seems to be the way they get around it. They've been very successful with that move, and I know I've been puzzling how to get around that for many, many years. And again, I think we've discovered a way to get around that, and we'll be sharing that on this next coming Saturday. But I just use $1,000 as a in face value Morgan Silver dollars as just kind of a standard idea. You know, again, some people want millions and millions of dollars. I've seen people sue for $100 million and $1 billion. And I mean, it's kind of out of logic. You know, again, as a base work, Morgan Silver dollars is about $26,000 in today's money, because they rent. Last time I looked, it was like a Morgan Silver dollar was like $26 each. You can get other junk silver, not Morgan Silver dollars, but other junk silver, which all kinds of different, you know, dimes and quarters and of course halves and silver dollars. Silver dollars are kind of hard to get in. Well, they can be gotten. But anyway, you know, last I looked, they're about $22 and some change, maybe close to $23 a piece. And that fluctuates. I'm not sure where gold is at. Last time I heard or looked, it was maybe around $1,900. I know a while back it went up to 2,000 and tipped over a little 2,000. I don't know if it's got back there or not. But the ratio, the proper ratio between the silver dollars and an ounce of gold is 20 to 1. So it's 20 silver dollars makes up one ounce of gold. And actually, and I don't know why it works out this way, but, you know, if you really go back and look, you find out it's like $19.94. I mean, I'm not sure where that comes from, but that's what I found in research. So we'll just call it $20. So 20 silver dollars equals 1 ounce of gold. So if you figure you're going out after maybe a group of individuals, like I know the case I'm running right now, it is, I believe there's 5 attorneys and a judge, so that's 6 individuals. Each one of them, 1,000 silver dollars face value, so that adds up quite quickly. Multiply that by numerous denials denials of some of your unalienable rights, particularly due process, which is the main one, but there are others. So maybe it's $3,000 or $4,000 each. I forget exactly where we ended up with that, because there were so many issues with that, and I think we did end up with $10,000 face value for each individual in a collective way. So again, you know, how one might want to look at this, people can put any number they want. What number do you think is, you know, is right? I mean, of course, ultimately, when you're denied any right, there's not enough money, especially if it's your freedom. I mean, you go to jail, I mean, there's not enough money, you know, that you can really think. But you got to come up with something reasonable. So, but some people are just get kind of ridiculous with it, and I think it's just a little much. Anyway, all right, that's it. Is there any announcements?
No, John, we don't. That was your last question, so.
Okay. All right, we're going to go right into the Q&A pretty quickly then. You know, we're doing, we've been working on this, you know, campaign for constitutional sheriffs. And, you know, the big thing is when a committee of safety gets going, they should purchase the book for their sheriffs. We have 3 states, and we've gotten books to, government by consent books to these sheriffs. And that's what we're asking all the committees of safety to do, to get a copy of the book, Government by Consent, in order to educate the sheriff. And so we have 3 states that have done that. And hopefully we can get someone that maybe go on kind of a campaign on their own to try to get a book to every single sheriff in their state. Because once we hit that point, then we want to try to talk with these sheriffs collectively So that's a thing I'm going to be trying to do soon. Don't know when, but it's going to take some time to put things together. If I can do it in the next couple of weeks, I will, but it might take longer than that. Depends on maybe if we get some more help doing things here at National Liberty Alliance, because we have a lot of work here to do and don't have enough volunteers to do it. But again, I want to make a contact with all of the sheriffs in these particular states, and we're going to write them a letter. They've already received the book. And we could do this with any sheriff that has received the book. Matter of fact, people should be doing this with any sheriff that receives the book. We'll share a copy of the letter, and a committee of safety can write it from their perspective and send it to their sheriff or whatever they want to do, or just have a conversation with their sheriff. But what we're offering is free access to the course that we've been running, Court Access in the Common Law, to all sheriffs and their deputies. Okay, so any sheriff or a deputy that comes out to NLA and becomes a member, we're going to set things up for them so that they can have free access to the course. And the course, in my opinion, has been pretty powerful. It's very heavy on the understanding of common law, and I think we've really put out a good course that gives people the access into the courts. It lays out what due process is and how each step of due process works, and given quite a few examples and forms and lots of information. I've been going through planning for the future sessions that we have going, and I've estimated, and I could be wrong on this, but I don't think I am, I've estimated we're going to have two more sessions to bring us to the end of the course. There's two more chapters to deal with, and I don't think any of these chapters are going to take two sessions to get through. I think we'll be able to do each of the next two chapters one session at a time. But if we need a third one, we'll do a third one. But anyway, that brings us kind of to the end, and for those who haven't been taking the course or just learning about it for the first time, the course is available to anyone at any time. It's been recorded, and you'll get the same benefit of the course that you'd get if you came to it live. The only difference is at the end of each one of these sessions, we have an open forum. So people will ask some questions focused in on whatever we covered or maybe covered over the last weeks. So we'd have a Q&A on that. But that's still available for Monday nights. So anybody taking the course, if the course has ended and you can't ask questions, obviously, at the end, you can come here on a Monday night and ask your questions. But a lot of times, a lot of the questions that people ask are questions that are also on other people's minds. So as you listen to other people's questions on the Q&A through each one of these sessions, you might find a lot of your questions answered. But again, if not, we're available here. I did mention on this course, I will be adding to this course from time to time as I learn new things. And I might call together for a new session, and I'll send an email to everyone that's taken that course. They were going to have a special session to add a chapter or a new part to the course, and we'll give a date when we're going to do it, and then we'll probably do it live. But it is possible I might start sharing things, maybe just recording it and putting it up and then notifying everybody of that. So not sure how I will do it. It depends on time. It takes time to put a lot of things together, and then it takes more time when you deliver that. So if I could deliver it at the same time I'm putting it together and recording it, then that may be the way to do it. But we'll see how it happens. I got a few different ideas and thoughts on some things I might want to add, but it's going to take a little time before I develop them and put it out. So anything I learn new, it will be out there. And the pages, and let me just give a little bit of a picture on these pages. Anybody who's in the course knows they can find this, but if you're not in the course, you won't be able to find these two pages. But here, Court Access in the Common Law, if you click on that box right there, you can fill out the application and join the course. We have all of the Court Access recorded video of the course. Let me just click on that to show. Oh, I'm probably not signed in. Yeah, let's log in. Okay, so let's take a quick look at the... Okay, this is what the page looks like for the courses that we've recorded. And by the way, we do give the first one for free, so people get an idea on how the course kind of operates and, you know, what's involved to some degree, at least the first part of the course. But anyway, all these courses are all these sessions recorded, each one of these is a recorded session all the way through. And like I said, it looks like we're going to have probably at least two more sessions and we should come to the end. What was that? Okay, let me see. Welcome. Okay, that is good. All right, we also record this in MP3s, which is probably the best way to study it. Once you've been through the course and watched everything live, you know, sometimes people don't have time to sit down and listen and watch at the same time because they are quite long and there's a lot of sessions to this. It's probably going to end up to be total of about somewhere between 90 to 100 hours at the most, but I think it's going to be turned out to be about 90 hours altogether. So it's a pretty in-depth course, and I think we've covered just about everything. But there's always something more, of course, that you know we need to look into. But as far as getting around and working into the court system, I think it's pretty in-depth. But again, the way I like to learn anything, if I get audio copies of whatever it is that I'm learning, and I put it in my MP3 player, and I just play them over and over again as I'm doing things, if I'm exercising or out in the pool or driving the car or being somewhere where I have to just wait around or something, I put on my headset and listen to these recordings. And then I've learned very well with that. I've been working on the two Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers. I've been listening to them. Right now I'm back onto the Federalist Papers, listening to that again. And I've listened to them numerous times. And, of course, you miss a lot, but you pick up something. And every time you go through it a second time, you pick up more things. And so your understanding, you know, builds up greater and you get more information as you get more information. But anyway, this is going to be available indefinitely. It'll always be here for people to download this information. Anybody who gets into the course, and then we'll add, again, anything new. Now, we have a page here, another page in the Court Access course, which is a Court Access table of contents. So this is the table of contents of the course itself. And this is where we have all the forms. Everything we're covering, you know, you'll find a copy here. And as you're writing papers or putting your case together, you know, you refer back. This is great reference points to go back to see maybe how I should write this paper, you know, what's the next step, do I have all the necessary papers to file, you know, correctly, and are they being filed right, and so on and so forth. And so we go all through the pleadings, and then we also teach people the causes of actions, the evidence and the affidavits, and the different motions that take place during the process of due process, and the different forms and memorandum of laws that we've written. And again, all these memorandums of law, you can make your own. You get a lot of information out of it, a lot of an understanding and knowledge of the law. Again, more forms and instructions, appeals, enforcement, extraordinary writs. And again, like I said, we're coming up to case examples this coming Saturday, where we'll be covering different kind of cases, jurisdiction challenge. We'll be covering how to move a case for cause, the IRS case that I put together. And again, we got some interesting things that I've recently learned that we're going to be, you know, talking about and teaching. And I think it's a way to really deal powerfully with these individuals. I had sort of an epiphany this past Saturday when I was teaching and talking about the writs. And I never really, you know, I always thought the writs were, they're reasonably powerful. You know, of course we have the writ habeas corpus, a very, very powerful writ. People should know how to use that, and we teach people how to use that. But also there are other kinds of writs. We've talked about the writ quo warranto, which we've been exercising quite a bit and talking about. And again, another powerful writ. But I never realized, I've used this before early on, but I never really understood how powerful this is and what its purpose is. For instance, like the writ of error, a very, very powerful paper to use on a judge when they break the law. when they step outside the law, or they receive fake facts from the other side, because they love to do that with paperwork, you know. They write letters to the judge. That's not part of common law, by the way. Not part of the process of a just court. So they write these letters to the judge, and they just write all this stuff in there that's not true, and then the judge makes a decision echoing what he saw in a letter and so on and so forth. And a writ of error might be the way to go on that. But anyway, there's other writs also. You know, there's errors on the law, and there's also an error on facts. And I also found a bunch of other types of writs. So I may do something special in the future on writs. I was working on it yesterday, and you know, kind of puzzling through some of these writs, and I think there's a lot to be really gleaned out of these writs that you can use. And a lot of these writs, even though they're going to ignore a lot of them, that's okay. Let them ignore them, because it's only a nail in their coffin, because it's the response that they give. And the breaking of the law and the denying of access into our courts, and that's a denial of due process, and that's a case in itself. And when they do that, and they do it collectively, because the lawyers write the paper and the judge responds, and then they get the cases thrown out, and that's a denial of due process. That also becomes fraud on the court. It also becomes conspiracy. So there's lots and lots of charges that can be applied upon these people. And each one of these charges is a damage against you. And again, it's just more that you can go for to get repaired, if anything. You know, usually money, of course, is the way to do it. For every injury, there must be a remedy. And so the remedy, of course, usually is money. Anyway, we'll be talking more as far as going into these cases that we put together. And they're real cases. I've used these cases. I've written these cases, so I've used them. Particularly over the past 6 months or so, I have a new strategy on traffic court and any kind of a code-based court system, you know, your village courts, your town courts, and most city courts. They're all Nisi Prius courts, and you can deal with them all the same way. You just curtail the facts of your case around the structure of the framework of the papers that we put together. So they'd be pretty powerful. And again, an important understanding is a paper that you write in order to move it into federal court for the cause. Usually, of course, the cause is a denial of due process, mostly. But any kind of a violation on an unalienable right is a cause. It's a cause of action. So anyway, that's what we'll be picking up on, and it'll always be available. This page also will always be available. People can download all this stuff and put it on their computer, of course, or they can just come up here whenever it's necessary and, you know, work in a case, and you work off this page. This is the paperwork that I use when I write a case, and I'm always back referencing different things and seeing different ways on how I might write a form. I mean, the forms we have are general forms, and you can just use them as they are, and you can kind of add to whatever you want, a little that you might want to do yourself. And a form is a form. It's just an idea and a uniform way of responding to the court. You just put your facts and your law into it. So, but it's pretty simple. You know, keep it simple. It really is very simple. The most difficult part, of course, is writing the case itself as far as putting your facts together and then finding the law that works with it, you know, that supports you. And we have tremendous amount of resources for that, tremendous. Everything you'll need to look for, you'll probably be able to find here. And anything that's missing, you can quickly find in Black's Law Dictionary, and of course we offer that as a download, or again you can watch it, you know, use it here online, but you can download it to your computer. Just open it up, it's a PDF, and save it. I think we give three dictionaries. I know we give one Bouvier's and one fourth edition for Black's, and I have second edition. I think we offered that too, but it's not much different between the second edition and the fourth edition. I haven't found any changes really per se. I know when you get to the sixth, I don't know about the fifth, But I know I have seen the sixth and seen some changes in the sixth, and I heard even get a little later it gets bad in a few places too, because they try to change the meaning of things. They try to take things out, you know. So anyway, okay, I guess that's all I got for that. Again, we're going to be pushing heavy on sheriffs and deputies. We need to educate our sheriffs and deputies. And again, anybody running a committee of safety, let your sheriff know, let your deputies know. Well, let the sheriff know to let the deputies know. They can come and take this free course, and it'll be really powerful for them, and it'll empower them for sure and enlighten them to what the common law is and what their true purpose is as a sheriff. Okay, with that, we're going to go into our Q&A. Anybody wants to get into the queue? We've got a few people in there right now. Let's go to our first person. Asula, you got the mic, go right ahead.
Oh, hi, John.
How you doing, Asula? You're from Missouri,
great.
Right?
Yes. Yes, I just have a couple, a few questions about the, LLC. I don't know if you know anything about which one is best for. We're trying to get an LLC, anonymous LLC. Is there such thing?
No such thing. I mean, somehow they may put it together if it's anonymous, but you're not going to be able to get a corporation going without using a social security number in order to open a corporation and get your VIN number. So there is no anonymous. It is true. It does offer you a lot more protection, but it does cause other problems. For instance, if you open a corporation and you had to go to court, you're going to have to hire a lawyer to represent you because you cannot go into a court to deal with a fiction without a lawyer. Now, I think that is wrong. I don't think they could really do that, but you're not going to win them that battle, at least not on this side of devolution. But maybe on the other side of devolution, you can win them that battle. Again, there's DBAs you can do, and you can get a PIN number for a DBA. And a DBA allows you, because it's, you're the person, you can then do it. There's ways I think you might be able to do trust, common law trust. But again, a common law trust is tricky because you have to have a beneficiary and you have trustees, and it's not a regular business per se, so you have to be careful how you set that up. But again, each one of these things, no matter what you do, you have to identify yourself as a, your phone number.
So what are you saying is that it doesn't matter the LLC or the, doing business as?
Yeah. By the way, as I'm talking or as someone else is talking, is there any feedback in the sense coming from my computer? I'm hoping not, because I have an open mic and my speakers are on, so. But as long as it's not feedback, let me know. Let's take on this side of devolution. On this side of devolution, it has always been advantageous for me to open up corporations. I've got numerous corporations that I've done business with over the past, 40, 50 years, whatever it's been. And, 45, almost 50 years. And so I've always had a corporation, and I've had numerous corporations for different things. And it works out great because it kind of puts a separation between you and the IRS. So corporations kind of protect you to some degree, okay, to some degree. And actually to a major degree, in my opinion, because I didn't know how to deal with these people when they started coming out after me. But that corporation has kind of created that buffer between myself and them. 23 years ago is when the IRS first started coming out after me. But they've never been able to break through. Once we're on the other side of devolution, I don't know, DBAs might be the good way to go. But corporations, again, they have a purpose, you know. If you have a lot of assets, if you have, for instance, let's say you're a contractor and you have a lot of machinery, okay, you would create a corporation which would be a holding company for all your machinery, and you put all your machinery in there. And then you go out, the big risk part is when you go out and do a contract and you engage in a contract. Well, you know, if you get, they can try to take everything you own, but if you have a different corporation and it's holding corporation and that corporation is renting out machinery to the other corporation, then it protects you in a way from, protects your assets, it protects the things you own. So, and there's, so there's different ways so that you can create different holding corporations. I've done that. And, of course, I created corporations actually to do the physical work with and as management and so on and so forth.
So when you talk about the corporation, are you talking about the LLC, the limited part? I mean,
I always, every corporation I ever opened up was an S corporation, which means you're limited in the number of employees you can have, and I believe 12 employees. But there's ways to get around that if you're going to have more people working for you. And again, you can do more corporations, and this one could be doing this part of the business, that one could be doing that part of the business. You know, when you get to be a really big company, you're not going to be able to stick with the S corporations. The benefit of an S corporation particularly is A, you know, your reporting is different. You don't get taxed double, okay? In other words, there's the tax that come out after you, and then after that, then the monies you take out, then they go out after the personal tax. With an S corporation, it's different than that. You don't get hit with that big corporate tax. So it's a smaller corporations. It does help those individuals. But again, once you get on the other side of devolution, I don't think you're really going to need it. The protection you want to make for yourself, you might use corporations in order to protect yourself from lawsuits, to protect your assets.
Okay, so the LLC is, we can't protect ourselves against that.
Well, the LLC is okay, but it's a different kind of a corporation. I've never opened one because I've always known that S corporations, from day one when I first started looking into this, and the way it was explained to me, I always found that it was much safer to stick with an S corporation because it's not as attackable as the other corporations. Okay. Again, they'll come out after you for taxes on those corporations, and then they'll come after you personally on your taxes. And again, I've never been too much involved with that. Again, with the S corporations, any of my companies have never been approached by the IRS or any government agency, and so they've never, you know, tried to break into those. They've come out after me on numerous occasions, and just by luck to some degree and doing the right thing at the right time, I've been able to avoid them until I accumulated the knowledge to be able to defeat them.
So what do you think about the private membership association? Is that a private membership association, PMA?
Yeah, I don't have too much knowledge in that, but I like to look at, if you're going to have a membership and open some organization, and if you, as long as you're going to be careful with the money and how things flow, and it's a non-profit type of thing, you do a trust. I mean, that's what I do, is a trust.
Okay.
A common
Okay.
Irrevocable.
So what about the UCC one? Is that something that we can we put the business in the UCC one or something like that?
Are you talking about religious or 501c1?
No, I think there's a UCC financial form that we
can. I don't have a lot of knowledge of corporations and structure and the best way. I only know what I've learned from myself as a contractor and how to do holding companies, how to, operate with the minimum amount of risk of lawsuit and availability of your assets. You get destroyed, you know, if they hit your assets and they take everything and you're out of business. That's kind of the basic knowledge that I've known and worked. I never looked deeply into these things. I never had a reason to. We're coming into a new world, by the way. And on the other side of the evolution is going to be a whole new world. And I would be guessing, and when we get to the other side of things, I'll try to become more accurate, but I think I'd be guessing a lot on how things will work. And again, at that point, on the other side of things, the necessity for corporations is really to protect your assets from individuals, not necessarily the government. Right now, on this side of things, I created it for the main purpose of protecting me from the government, and it also fulfilled the need to protect me from individuals. But I've never been sued by a client or anything, whereas they want anything anyway. I've never been sued by them. I've sued them, but I've never been sued by them.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been lucky to be out of that kind of a situation.
Yeah, we have an automotive business. It's a repair, you know, service, and I was just wondering what would be the best way to, you know. So you say the devolution, I need to go in there and read up on that?
Are you familiar with devolution?
I heard of it, but I haven't really.
Okay, well, if you come under today's issues, okay, and you come down, look on devolution right there. I don't know if you're looking on your desktop, but it's the fourth one down under today's issues. Click on devolution, watch through all that, and you'll get a lot of information. Also, some of the things that will be helpful on how things happened. Anarchy USA is pretty powerful, but devolution is one of the first key things. Let me see what else might be here. Knowledge of the New World Order is helpful, of course. Let's see, the Great Awakening, help you a little bit on that too. A lot of stuff is in here that's really good. But what about devolution? That's what you want to click on, that fourth tab. Videos, we got a lot of videos. Well, this one's not found. I'm not sure which one that is. I'll have to check in to see what's going on with that one. I'll try to remember. That was, let me see, where is it? This one here, I think. Came from Rumble. I'm surprised that that's not there. So, but let's see, all the rest of the videos are there. So it's pretty good, pretty powerful. And I think you'll learn a lot about devolution there. And also on the news, you know, if you come and listen to the news, today's issues, well, let's see, NLA, well, that's our interviews. Where do we have this? We do have a page where we have news. Access, like X22 is a good place to get information.
Right, I do. I'm subscribed to him, so yeah.
And also Christian Patriot News has some pretty good information sometimes.
Christian Patriot. Okay.
I like Amazing Polly, you know, and Q News Patriot. That's another one.
Right.
Where is Q News Patriot? Right here. Q News Patriot. Okay. That was the other one I was looking. So it's a few more under devolution. But devolution will give you the picture and tell you what devolution is about.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All righty. Okay, we'll take our next caller. Rhett, you got the mic. Go right ahead. Rhett?
Hello?
Go right ahead.
You can hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay. Is pleading mandatory or voluntary?
When you say you're pleading, in other words, they call you into court and they ask you to make a plea?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, pretty much any court you called into, you can deny. And you can say you're here by special appearance to test the jurisdiction of the court. And in theory, more than in theory, in fact, it's just going to be hard to make a case. It doesn't matter what court you go into. It's not a common law court. It's not a court of record. They always open civil law courts. That's what they open up. Even the state courts, even the federal courts, they all open up civil law courts. They won't say that outright, but that's what they're opening. So, you know, if you understand how that's structured together and you understand how things work, you then could make that position and make the argument. And we do teach how to make that argument in the course, as far as challenging the jurisdiction, and if you're in there, like a criminal court, that's a civil law court. That's not a court of record. A criminal court, their civil courts are not courts of record. So you could make an argument, not that they're going to buy it so easily, but you could make it on paper, and it could be pretty powerful if only they would step back and actually apply logic and justice to it, they would agree with you.
And if they just keep continuing saying, well, we're here for the purposes of pleading?
Well, again, you know, criminal is going to be hard to fight if it's a criminal thing, okay? But for any other reason other than that, I'd make the battle, and then I'd do a collateral attack on the court. First, I would do a challenge of jurisdiction. Then I would do a writ of error. And the purpose of a writ of error, how I would use it, how I'm seeing that it should be used, is really making the case on the case, your case on the case. For instance, you know, whenever you're battling a case, you always got to be thinking of an appeal. And you want to build your case as you go and your arguments and everything, getting ready for the appeal. Okay, you're always looking forward, I'm going to be appealing this thing because I may lose and I've got to be ready to appeal it. So you're always making that. And we teach a little bit of that, and you know, even in the trial part on how you do your objections, because your objections prepare you for the appeal. If something is said and done wrong in the court and you don't appeal, you know, if you don't object, I mean, if you don't object, then that option for appealing that is on those basis that you should have objected to is not available. So you should always object to things. And sometimes, even if you're not sure, but you know something's wrong, but you want to object, well, what are you objecting for? Well, I need to think about it. I object. I'm going to respond on paper. You know, that kind of thing. Generally, I wouldn't think that that would happen in the trial court, of course, because the trial court, everything is now fixed. But we're talking about when you're in a court and you're going through different arguments in the court itself as you're moving your case forward. You know, you're going through motions and discoveries and moving different things around and, you know, structuring your case. So from that kind of an idea, you always write and build your case as if you're going to have to appeal it. So you make sure you cover all your bases. So when a judge steps out of his authority, his jurisdiction, and he violates the law, he steps outside the law, he steps outside his own rules, he steps outside his jurisdiction, any of those things. And they do it all day long, every day. I don't think I've ever been in a courtroom where they haven't done it. They always do it, all day long. They don't obey their own rules, they don't obey the law, they don't obey nothing. They're purely 100% lawless. That's my observation over the years I've been in court. And so you make that case, and I haven't done this before because, again, I'm just learning a little bit more about writs. I have written a writ of error, but I didn't know where to go with it or really didn't understand its purpose, but now I do. And so I will start to use writs of errors to build my case. So they break the law, they move a certain way, I give them a writ of error. I write the law, the case, inside the case. And, again, we're going to be talking about that this coming Saturday. So I'll write all of the law of the case inside my case and refer it to it. Now they've been fully informed of the law and what's going on. So that when they break the law, and they break the law of the case particularly, I refer back, let them know they've been fully informed of the law, you've made an error, you need to correct it, this is your error, blah, 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 blah. And again, as I get, because I know I'm going to have some experience in this in the future, and as I get those things together, I'll package it together and add to the course so that people can learn more on it. So as I'm learning, you'll learn more too. But, you know, now you're building your case. So now they've got to respond to some degree. I mean, even ignoring it. And when you know, silence when they have a duty to speak is fraud. That's the name of that tune. That's closed case. That's it. So if they don't respond, you know, you can respond back, you know, that they've been fully informed and your silence, when you have this duty to respond and answer, as I put forward in the writ of error, you know, I'm not sure exactly how I would word it, but something like that. And you have not you failed to respond, and silence when you have a duty, being a judge, you have a duty to respond, and you state silence, well, that's fraud. So I put that into the case. And again, I have to think about how I would write that. I think I would try to find a much more elegant way of saying that than the way that I just said it. For lack of an elegant way at the moment, you know, just putting it out raw. So that's what I would do, and then you go on. And then you see, and then when they do something else, you let them know about another error. Errors in facts. I mean, this is one I didn't know about until recently. I didn't think about it until recently. I didn't think much about the writs except for the habeas corpus and the quo warranto. But now I'm seeing all these other writs. I'm saying, wow, and these are the writs. These are the prerogative of the king. That's our writs. They're for us to use. And so, you know, they don't think so. And they may not recognize it, but I don't care. It doesn't matter when it comes down to the end game. The truth is the truth, and that's it. For instance, we have a lawyer that wrote papers and wrote a letter to the judge and gave a summary of the case, our case that we put together. They gave a summary, and lied. Now, the judge never reads the paper. I think in this case he has read the paper. But, they can turn around and say, well, I've never read the paper. I'm responding on what the lawyer said. He's an officer of the court. He's trustworthy. You know, he's holding an office of trust. I can trust what that man said. Okay? So I responded to his paper, but I didn't respond properly. I should have responded, and again, I didn't know about it at the time. I should have responded with a writ of error on the facts. Okay? That would have been a lot more stronger than the way I did respond to it. But I responded it as a reply to his answer. And his answer was really to throw me out on Rule 12, and he didn't answer anything that's in the case. He ignored it and just lied on what the case was and did it by letter. Okay? And so the judge thinks he has a place to hang his hat, you know, because judges don't read the papers, the case, and they really just read the papers that come before them as motions are made. And if it becomes necessary to read the papers, then they do, otherwise they don't. So he kind of thinks he's got a place he can hang his hat and hide behind a rock and say, well, look at, if you ever get caught in this thing, well, look at, I didn't read the case. It's not normal that we read the case. We're just responding to the argument that's before us, and you know, because that's what the RJI is for the judicial, judicial interference is what I call it, but the judicial intervention. And in any event, he thinks he can hide. So what I did do it in a good way, in the sense when I wrote my paper in response to that letter and answered every detail and showed every lie and did it by affidavit, I started off with, again, making the point that this was a court of record and that on and for the record I respond to, and then named the paper, that letter, and went through all the details. But immediately after getting that letter, and I responded very quickly, and I also responded with a jurisdictional challenge very quickly. So, I mean, when they moved me to federal court, I immediately wrote a jurisdictional challenge. And when I did all that, the judge didn't answer the jurisdictional challenge. He didn't respond to my affidavit or the fact that this guy was just doing nothing but lies. He's a U.S. attorney. He's lying before the court. He's a person who's supposed to have a position of honor. He's an officer of the court, and he's lying to you, Judge. And this is the fact. And this is the fact. And this is the fact. And he said that we didn't have any law. I listed out a page of law that we have laid out in this case. But within days after that, paper went through, and my paper followed behind, and within days, he just threw the case out. Then I did a collateral attack, and that's the powerful one. That's the one that they have a problem with, and that's the one, and that's the way you can do for every case. You can follow a process of writs of error, laying out writs of errors in facts, writs of error in law, and also, you know, pushing the fact that you've got the law of the case, they've been fully informed, and then move it for a collateral attack upon the court, because a higher court can sue a lower court in opposed to going to appeal. And that didn't really sink on me. I've known this for a while, but it really didn't sink on to me until recently, that it really had my epiphany and realized, wait a second here, I don't have to appeal. I'm always going to lose the appeal also. It costs you more money, okay? And I always lose the appeal because they always do the same thing. But a collateral attack, a whole different story, and it's a whole different thing. Now what are you going to do? And now another judge has to come into the game, and what's he going to do? Well, I attacked the court, the lower court, which was a nisi prius court. I'm a court of record. I'm a higher court. I attacked his court, sued them all kinds of ways for all kinds of issues. I mean, refused to put onto the record what the jurisdiction of the court was. Refused to hear. All things stop when you challenge jurisdiction. That's the law. Refused to stop the case, continued to move forward to throw us out of the court. And numerous other things, just a whole bunch of things. And so we went after him for all of those things, and it came up to be quite a bit of money. And then there's other monies involved in this because you've got to get back to the original case. But this ended up with $10,000, Morgan Silver dollars for each of the officers of the court. And we went out after them for fraud on the court and just a whole bunch of things, conspiracy, denial of due process, and a few other things. And the way this court case went, and it's really kind of simple when I look back and think about it, it's not that complex. It may sound a little complex, but it's not. Looking back, and you know, we're going to lay this case out next Saturday, and I think people are going to see the real simplicity of this. Now, there is a letter that he wrote, and there was a response that I did go respond to them. I didn't feel it necessary to share in his case, but I might just kind of put the letter up there and put the response to the letter in reference to it without getting into details on it. And then people, if they have questions on it, they can ask me questions. But, you know, to see how I responded to the lies and then also I could have turned that into a writ of error on facts and law. And I didn't think in that way at that point. I didn't have the knowledge, the realization of doing that at that time. But I do now. So next time I do the same thing, but I would do it in a writ of error, which is more powerful in my opinion.
So have we covered the collateral attack process in the course at all yet?
That's going to be Saturday. Next Saturday.
Oh, that's going to be Saturday. Okay.
Now, next Saturday, I'll tell you what we're going to be looking at. Let's see. Okay, next Saturday, we're going to be looking, we're in chapter 11. So we're going to cover a jurisdictional challenge, okay? I'm going to show you the argument and the paperwork and all the forms for that. We're going to look into the move for cause, which would be the paperwork and all the forms for that. And then we're going to use the IRS with a collateral attack, which I'm going to cover the action, the collateral attack, and a memorandum that I've used and some forms and papers and books that you know, people should be looking into, but not necessarily for this part of the case. I mean, all the paperwork and forms needed for, you know, working this stuff out really is already found out earlier on in forms and instructions and appeal forms, you know, and we forms throughout this whole thing. So each step has its own form. But this was just the action and the collateral attack upon it. And I might add in here a paper for what this U.S. attorney did by letter and how I responded and brought it into the case on and for the record, and I brought the letter into the case. So that I did do. I could have done it through bringing it in through a writ of error, which would have been very close to the way I wrote it anyway. Okay, I just didn't call it a writ of error. But I'd be more specific and be able to put a little more law in there. But we'll be covering the collateral attack and all the and different paperwork. We'll be covering a lot of attachments and exhibits. Memorandum of oath bond concerning pettigrew. You know, another thing on a case is getting into the case a copy, and I did that on the action. We're going to cover that a little bit. Getting into there paper for a untainted jury, in this case the trial jury. So we put the jury handbook in there, which is about 40 some odd pages if I remember, and that's an important one because once you have that in the case, now we can correct the jury, we can fix the jury, and when a jury is selected, you can also make some arguments there. And they, well, you can't go, well, hey, it's in the case already, nobody objected to it, you know. No objection, you agreed. So here it is, and I'm bringing it up. You want to debate it? You want to argue it? Let's do it. I know I could win in logic and in fact and in law. I can win, no doubt, hands down. They will only win through illogic and fraud, and that'll be proven on the case itself, and it would be a case against them. Again, you want to break the law? You want to deny the rules, common law? Or your own rules, it's okay, go do it. Now I'm going to sue you for it and we'll put a collateral attack upon your court because they're coming in under different jurisdiction. And also, you know, they hijack you to jurisdictions unknown. That's another charge against them. So anyway, we're going to be covering that in good detail, I think, next Saturday.
Okay. So writ of error. I'm sorry, some feedback. The writ of error, is that in?
Yes, we covered that. We covered writs last week. We didn't spend a lot of time on it. We just looked at all the different writs that were available. There was quite a few of them, and we had a paragraph or two on each one of the writs. And that's when I was having my epiphany, and I may come back to do more on a writs. at a later time. I want to do some, I'm going to use them and I'm going to explore with them, and I'll share that in this course by adding at the end of this course as time goes on. So, I mean, I could come up with something new next month or come up with something new next year, and if it's something that's valuable, I'll put it into the course and you'll get a letter, an email telling you, hey, there was some additional stuff put into the course. Either we're going to do it live or it's already been done, one or the other.
Okay, so what is a key indicator that a judge has stepped out of bounds or his jurisdiction?
Well, again, that's where understanding, that's why I spent a lot of time on common law. That's why we spend so much time on memorandums and everything to get the view, to know the rules of the common law, which is really purely logic. That's all it is. It's common sense. You know, in America, the people have lost their common sense. We've fallen into a pit, and we even question our own common sense. Because as time goes on, you get all these people agreeing and moving down the way that they're bringing you, and you start to question your own sanity for a while, at least early on. You know, once you wake up, you realize this whole thing is a conspiracy of destruction. But in any event, when they do something, when they break a rule, okay, they do it all day long, every day. Everything that judge does, everything, every move they make, everything that these lawyers put in to try to throw you out, okay, you need to explore it very, very carefully to see and realize potentially that they're breaking the rules and they're breaking the law. One of the most powerful ones, and again, it's like they've been hypnotized. It's like the emperor has no clothes, and they look at the emperor, they still see the emperor with clothes on. But the emperor has no clothes, and it takes a while because they've been so full of poison. I think they really have a hard time seeing this. I mean, I've had some conversations with lawyers who I could not convince that we're not under Roman law. They have no clue to this. They don't understand. They may think our whole law structure was copied by Rome. That's nothing to be further from the truth. But in any event, lawyers are very difficult to tell. But let's take this. You go to their rules. Let me get to their rules real quickly. Here it is, rules. Okay, this is their rules, rules of federal civil procedure, okay? As you go through this, okay, this is the actual rules they have. Now, right here in the beginning, authority for promulgation of rules, Title 28 USC, subsection 2072, and that's where all the rules are, okay? So they write, rules of procedure and evidence, power to prescribe. And that's the other thing, rules for evidence? What are you talking about, rules for evidence? I don't need no rules for evidence. All my evidence I want to bring in, and all my evidence should be heard. I mean, there are some arguments that may be able to be made concerning evidence, and they'd be valid, okay? For instance, if a particular piece of evidence that you're bringing in isn't documented, then it's invalid, and you can make that argument, and you could win that argument. But anything other than things of that nature, because they don't like the evidence, no. And I've seen a lot of cases where they just get rid of all the evidence on the other side. All right, but anyway, here's what the Supreme Court wrote. The Supreme Court shall have power to prescribe general rules of practice and procedure and rules of evidence for cause in the United States District Courts, including proceedings before magistrate judges thereof and courts of appeal. Such rules, and this is the key point now, and believe me, it's like talking to the wall with these people. Nevertheless, put in the case, it's stone cold logic. Anybody anybody that has taken the poison may not see this unless they have gotten the remedy. And the remedy to the poison is the law, okay? The real law. It's called common law. That's the remedy. It's the only cure to the poison that they give in bar schools. Such rules, this is what the United States, this is what the legislators wrote, okay? Such rules shall not abridge, enlarge, or modify any substantive right. All laws in conflict with such rules shall be of no further force or effect after such rules have taken effect. Okay, well, you go down to rule one, I think it is. Let me think, unless it's two. Pretty sure it's rule one, first rule. And it just destroys the entire Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and it just destroys every rule in every court across the nation. Okay, and its scope of rules, form of action. Rule 1, scope and purpose. Rule 2, one form of action, all on page 1. Now, if I recall reading this, they kind of hid this, but it was very clear on their website, the meaning of this, because they expound on meaning of this. And this is it. These rules, this is Rule 1 and Rule 2. Rule 1, these rules govern the procedures in all civil actions and proceedings in the United States District Courts, except as stated in Rule 81. They should, and I'm not sure what that is on that. They should be construed and administered to secure the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of every action and proceeding. And that's a lie straight from hell. Right from hell, that's a lie. Because if anything, it has caused more problems and it's made things much more expensive. Anyway, Rule 2, one form of action. And this is a game they played right there. One form of action. There is one form of action, the civil action. What happened to law, which is the common law? What happened to equity? How can there be one form of action? How could we be under civil law when we're under common law? Right there, it destroyed the entire pay. Everything in here is null and void. It's the idea of the fruit of the poisonous tree. Okay? Now, let me go over here, and Federal Rules of the Court, let's see, Memorandum Rule 12B, I know I have it in here somewhere, New York Rules, Pettit, no, Rules of the Court, let me see where that's at, I know it's in here somewheres, where on the website itself, they're very clear on the meaning of that, and what they said is they took, if I can't find it quickly, at least I'll explain what it says, and I'll try to find it and throw it up a little later. I'll have to find it and throw it up. But what it says basically on the Supreme Court cases, on the Supreme Court's website, they talk about the form here in the rules, which is one form civil law, and they explain it. They said what they did is they took common law and they took equity. They put them together under one form and called it civil law. Now, we're not under civil law. Civil law is Babylonian law. A better word for it or a better identity for it is municipality law or Babylonian law, because that's what it is. It's the control of the people of the city. That's the purpose, to control the people of the city, to keep the slaves in line. That's what it's for. And it all benefits the state and not the people. And it strips you of all rights. And moving it into civil then brings you into civil rights instead of unalienable rights, rights coming from God. And we've become so blind to this, it's pretty pathetic, because we've become so blind, we actually allow them to debate our Bill of Rights. That's against the law. You know, that's a crime. It's 2 years in jail, I think, maybe even more than that. I forget exactly. But that's a crime, okay? If you come into power and you take your position of power and use it as a springboard in order to defeat the Constitution, that's an assault upon the Constitution, and that's an assault upon the people, and it's a crime, okay? And yet, they do it all day long. They debate and argue about gun control. They debate and argue about we can't talk anymore. You know, they've destroyed every one of our rights. We don't have a right to redress of grievances. They throw you out of the court. You know what? Redress of grievances. I know Robert Schultz has been twice up before the Supreme Court, once up before the United States Supreme Court, but he's moved a second time. He didn't make it back up the second time. And recently they put a paper together with another person. I was involved a little bit with that. But they did it more in a civil focus and not a common law focus. And each time they were thrown out, telling them, you know, and they went up for a redress of grievances and they were thrown out of the court saying you don't have standing. Well, right there, that's a denial of due process. We all have standing. Anybody who's got a beating heart has standing, okay? If you're one of the people, you have standing. If you're one of God's children, if you're one of God's creation, as far as a human being is concerned, you have standing. And so that's a lie to begin with. But the denial, that's a First Amendment right, the right of redress of grievances. Okay, so if you have that right of redress of grievances and you deny that, you've just been denied your due process right there. So that's how I would take that court case. And I'm going to talk with Bob Schultz about that, about pushing, because now Bob Schultz has come around. You know, he didn't buy into this common law. never really paid attention to it. And he's brilliant in a lot of things he's done and put together and a lot of stuff he's done. But now he finally had the time to sit down and he realizes and he sees it now. So I might be able to convince him about going in and opening that case back up and going and suing the United States Supreme Court. I would sue the United States. I'd perform a collateral attack upon the United States Supreme Court. That's what I would do if it was my case. And that would really raise some eyebrows, I would imagine. But again, you know, we have to be bold, we have to be pushy, and we have to go for the jugular because they have no mercy upon us. So
yeah.
Why should we?
An attorney did tell me that there was no more common law or commonwealth.
Yes. They say it all the time. That's how ignorant they are. You know, the question you ask to them, here's the question you ask them next time you come into that conversation. How did you get there? First of all, they don't even know. So I'll help them, you know, if they don't know. Well, I'll tell you how you got there. And you don't even know how you got there. Rules Enabling Act of 1934, executed in 1938. Through the rules, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, that's how you got there. And by rule, in Rule 2, they abrogated the common law. That's what they did. So the United States Supreme Court, by rule, abrogated the common law, and whereas the legislators can't even do that, nobody can do that. That's the go up against God. That was a covenant between we the people and God in the Declaration of Independence. To be under his blessings of his liberty and living under his law in return for being obedient to his law. And that was the whole thing. That's what the Declaration of Independence ultimately was about. I mean, it accomplished the separation and the severing away from the king, of course. But nevertheless, it was a covenant with God. And if you go into history, they've wrested everything, all their accomplishments. They never should have won any of this stuff. And they all acknowledge the fact, only but by the grace of God, that he kept us along the way. He's the one who won all our battles. And they all acknowledge that.
So if a judge says, well, if you're not going to plea, I'll enter you in a plea of not guilty. Is that
if you're going to go in there, you see, that's what they do. They trap you into making a plea. Once you've made a plea, you've agreed to the process. And that's how they get you. They don't even understand what they're doing, but that's what they were taught to do. And that kind of a procedure brings you into the game. But what it doesn't cover is the fact that the whole thing is a fraud. So it really can be turned all against them, and you can sue them for everything you've got. You can come back 10 years. You could have been found guilty. You could have been serving 5-10 years in jail, and you could have gotten out and been out in the world another 5 years, and then you come have this realization, whoa, wait a second, that whole thing was a fraud. Well, you can go back and sue. It doesn't matter how long. It could be 20, 30 years later. As long as the evidence is still there, then your case is still there. Okay? But they do what they want. So the response to that, whenever you go into a court, And they want to get a plea. You know, you're here to make a plea. Are you going to plead guilty or not guilty or no contest? What are you going to do here, buddy? Well, I'm here by special appearance. I'm challenging jurisdiction, so I don't have to plead nothing until you prove challenge diction. Once jurisdiction is challenged, it must be decided. And that's where you're at, and that prevents them from taking a plea. Then you lay out the fact this is an nisi prius court. It's not a court of record, has no power or authority over me, has nothing to do with me. You have only one choice but to dismiss this case or we're going up to the feds. Remove this to the federal court for cause for denial of due process. And hijacking me into jurisdictions unknown. Those are the two main focuses. Okay?
Okay. Okay, so the law of the case, I saw that there's paperwork in there. Is that something you take out and you add with the paperwork, or is that something you develop and write up?
Well, you know, I've been both ways on this. And one way I put it into the case. Another way I put it in, I referenced it from outside the case in a memorandum attaching it to the case. And then I put it back into the case. And then recently I was thinking about taking it out of the case, but now I'm pretty convinced now, because I've really puzzled this back and forth and literally moved back and forth with it, and back to here and back to here. And I finally came to a conclusion of my puzzlement, because I think all the pieces fit now. No, I put it right in the case. And I'll give you an example. Okay. The IRS action. Here's the IRS action. Okay, this IRS action is, let's see, how many pages is it? I don't even remember. It's 33 pages, okay? Includes a summons and everything, all right? Now, one of the things I add into the case, so let's go back up here to the table of contents. On the table of contents in this case, I did put the law of the case right into the paperwork right here. I don't want to move that. Hang on a second. Right here, okay? Page 5 through 11. This is the law of the case, okay? So I lay everything out. This is a court of record. Here are the rules. We proceed according to the rules of the common law. I will accept any rule for the federal procedures or any other court. I'll accept their rules as long as they're in harmony and not in contradiction with the rules of common law. Okay, in other words, they have to make sense. They have to have common sense to it. It has to be righteous and just. Okay, and the other thing is, I put in here Rule 12b-6, fully informed. Well, Rule 12b-6 is not part of the common law process, and it's a denial of due process, can't use it. So they've already been fully informed, and yet they use it anyway. Did I say 6? I meant to say 12 if I said 6. Rule 12 is 12b-6. Again, I'll hit them 3 times on this, because I hit them here, then I'll hit them on a writ of error or correction, and then I'll hit them a 3rd time on a collateral attack upon the court, which is to sue the court directly. Do not pass go. That's it. We're here. I'm suing you directly, and I'm going after damages. Plus, my case is going back, and I'm having it sent back down to the New York State level, and have the case tried by a jury down there. So that's one. That's part of the wherefore clause in my case here in this battle.
So how do you get a jury? Is that something you request a judge to do,
request? You tell them. As long as if the case is a criminal case, they have to give it to you by law. And if it's a civil case, you have to demand it. You don't request it. You demand it. And you demand it. I demanded it here. Jurisdiction, court of record, also known as common law, and if you look under the court of record, actually, if I recall, I actually did change this paperwork. Let me get back into the federal papers. I changed it, and I added in here trial by jury. But nevertheless, court of record right there proceeds according to the course of the common law, and that refers to a court of record, which brings us to a trial by jury. A court of record is a trial by jury. If there's no jury trial involved, it's not a court of record. Okay, these are all summary judgments at that point, and you're trusting that the judge is honorable and just and is going to maintain justice. But they're not going to do that, especially if it's a case against the status quo or one of his friends.
Okay, is doing any of this will cause them to find me in dishonor?
You're not in dishonor. They're in dishonor. No, they're going to have a problem. I don't see how they can do that. Again, you know, their logic bending can only go so far. I don't think that they can bend their logic that far, to be honest with you. But you never do know what they could or would do. I mean, I've always been a little careful over time on what I do. And maybe I've been too cautious sometimes. And you know, because, you know, there's nothing more dangerous than ignorance and action, especially if they got the guns. But no, I don't worry about it no more. I don't think there's much they can do. I think it'd be too much of an overreach at that point, because you're suing them directly at this point. And the key thing is this: when you sue a judge and all the officers of the judge, and you sue them for Rule 12 for throwing you out, and the whole thing is denial of due process. What is due process is the question, and this question's been brought up before, and I've answered it, and I think recently I've answered it even much more clearly. Due process is this. This is due process. I'm going to show you what due process is, okay? Due process is starting with the pleadings, okay, coming all the way down, until we get to the trial itself. Well, where is it? Jurisdiction, rich forms, okay, thought it was here. Okay, to the trial. Okay, that's due process, and everything else down here is inside here anyway. It's just the way it's put together. So all of this is due process. You can't be denied, including this. It didn't turn blue, but it should have been. Okay, all of this is due process. Everything from the pleadings to the trial is due process. Everything along that line, all the motions, discovery, the debates, the arguments, bringing in the evidence, documentations, memorandums, all of that is part of due process. Deny me one part of that due process, and you've denied me my due process. You see, so I'm suing them for that purpose. How are they going to argue that? Okay, because it throw me out of court, and a free man can't lose his court. And that's also in American jurisprudence. Okay, so they already know that. So that is written in American jurisprudence. And it comes from the common law. It goes back, you know, 1,000 years. Well, maybe not quite. It goes at least back to the Magna Carta, 800 years. Maybe even longer than that. But in any event, so you take you now sue them. So what happens? That removes everyone from the game. They can't even participate in the old case anymore because I'm suing them. It's a conflict of interest. It's a problem. So all those people have to get all new lawyers again now to fight that case down the line. So now we're in a new case, a case against the court. And so it's my court against their court. So a judge has to come into play. And I ask for a jury again. Okay, it's court of record. I want a trial by jury. So now I'm suing the judge. I'm suing all five lawyers. One of them is a U.S. attorney. Now a judge comes into play. And they start, what are they going to do? They're going to ask to throw us out on Rule 12? That's what this case is all about. And what are you going to do? If they put papers like that or try to throw me out, or the judge makes a move to throw me out, I mean, it's got to be a real moron not to think it out. I mean, look, for goodness sakes, I'm suing a judge and I'm suing a U.S. attorney and I'm suing four other attorneys for denying my right of due process. And now, from the judge's perspective, thinks, well, I'm going to throw this guy out now and think that he's not going to sue me and the other lawyers that are representing in this court, and he's going to not have another case because he knows that's what's going to happen. So he has no choice to let the case to go through. And we're going to a jury trial. There's nothing that they can offer. They can offer $1 billion. We're going to a jury trial because we're here for another purpose. We're here to save the court.
And that's in district court, correct? Or
I would allow this case to be argued in a federal court, but I'll make my case that it should be argued down on the state level. And I could win that argument, I believe. I definitely will win the argument in the first case. And the reason why I would end the argument, win the argument, is because of the fact that the law says that once an individual, steps outside of their jurisdiction, they lose all protection of the states. All protection of the state. All protection. They have no blanket, no cloak, nothing. They're no longer agents. They're in disgrace. They're not an agent. They're not a member of the court anymore, so they don't have an honorable position. Okay? They broke the law. Well, there's no reason to be in a federal court at that point. Besides that, I don't think a federal court can hear that kind of case anyway. I mean, I want to know what jurisdiction they would hear this under. Okay, I'd like to hear what this would be. I don't think they'd know what to do, to be honest. You know, they got 57 jurisdictions and they got law, but law is to protect the Constitution. It's very, very specific and very careful. Now, it is a denial of due process, so they might be able to make a case from that end, and that's fine. I'll still go on that. I can live with that anyway. I'll make the battle in the federal court or state court. It doesn't matter to me.
So, if I receive something in the mail, the fact that they didn't have a deputy or sheriff serve me with a summons, that would be a violation of due process, right?
No. There's numerous ways to serve a person. You can serve a person through the mail as long as it's done properly. You can serve a person through a private server or through the sheriff. The warrants can only be served by a sheriff, but papers for a court case. Now, I will tell you what, because the IRS did what they did through the mail, that became mail fraud. that's heavy. They made that heavy duty. I mean, it's like 20 years in jail for mail fraud. Okay, they use the mail to commit their fraud by sending you all this paper and bombarding you and that's another position I made. Okay, I don't remember what I made in this case. I might have. I probably did, but I have in the past the case I won against the IRS, which really wasn't a win. In my case, they gave me an apology letter. They told me I wasn't liable for taxes, and they claimed to have rescinded. They gave me a release of lien, and all of that is just evidence of more fraud because they just put more paper and proof of fraud on the record and gave it to me and signed it and sealed it, okay? So, I mean, these people don't think, okay? What happens is when they get stuck in court, when someone figures out a way to beat them, and they get stuck in that court, then they put their minds together and they formulate a plan and a procedure and a process to deal with that problem. And when it comes this way, you do it this way, and you come down. Well, what I just attacked them with, they haven't got a plan for it. And I don't know that they can even create a plan to go after that. Matter of fact, my first case that I had won against them, the fact that they gave me a letter telling me that I don't have to pay taxes, that I'm exempt from that, and that they said I wasn't liable for taxes, and they gave me a release of lien. That means they didn't know what the heck to do with me. Now this was kind of early on, and they still had a lot of knowledge to get. Matter of fact, I wasn't even sure how I won the case. I was thinking of two different ways I won this case. I wasn't sure which one it was, and so. I was going after them for money, but I didn't even pursue it after that. I accepted that and walked away, figuring, well, okay, I won the case. So I'm sure they made that case disappear. As a matter of fact, they did something in that case. I should look it up. Maybe it's more fraud, because I was in court with someone else, and this lawyer brought this case up. Oh, this guy here, he's been in the court. He went up against the IRS and blah, 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 and he found and he lost there. But I didn't lose. I won. And I could have proved that. And I remember which case that was and what happened with that case. I just don't remember because I got so many of them. But in any event, the bottom line is I got paper that proves more fraud that they gave me to get rid of me. So I didn't pursue the money is my point. I was just happy to walk away. And after 20 years of just badgering me, okay, I finally got them off my back. You know, it's a lot of stress when the IRS is after you, because you know what and the more you battle with them, and the more you fight, then the more risk you put yourself into, and potential, they're looking to put you in jail and all that stuff. So it's a lot of stressful. I'm going to sue them again, but right now I'm in a suit with them for someone else. I'm working with them to do the case.
So when
person, if you got more, get back in line, all right?
I'm sorry?
If you have any more questions, get back in line, because we have other people.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Good questions. Thanks. PRES, Prez, what state you're from?
Good evening. How you doing? I'm from North Carolina.
North Carolina. All right, Ed, you got the mic.
Okay. What I wanted to do was more engage you on devolution. Mm-hmm. My background is I spent 20 years in the Air Force and 12 years in the intelligence community. Mm-hmm. And I was a pretty high-ranking person in on the joint staff. I did all the intelligence dissemination for 5 classified networks. And I'm very familiar after 32 years of a continuity of government and devolution, and I wanted to see if you had actually considered participating in devolution, because my perspective on devolution is
hold on, did you say have I ever considered what, participating?
I'm going to suggest to you an idea here, because my assessment right now is devolution is really not going that well. The Federal Reserve and some other institutions have proven to be quite resilient, and they're dragging things out much further. And I kind of thought that maybe the Patriots had wrong-footed the Fed when they took Silicon Valley Bank down. And, of course, there were a lot of wealthy people involved in that bank. And so what does Janet Yellen do? Well, she goes ahead and she makes all the depositors who lost their deposits whole. And then when she was questioned by Congress on that move and said, well, what about my depositors in Oklahoma? And she said, well, that would have to be, you know, I would have to agree with it, and the chairman of the Fed would have to agree with the president, because, you know, we would only do that if it was a systemic risk. So basically what she was doing is admitting that, you know, Ma and Pa are not going to get bailed out. They're not, you know, their deposits are going to be lost. But anyway, I thought the Patriots had wrong-footed them, because the Fed wants this crisis, this financial crisis, to happen this fall. And they always do that. That was their thing. And I thought they'd perturb the system. And so, you know, I probably should not go on that too much. But the bottom line is that there's a flow. You're in a battle rhythm here. And there's a given flow between both sides. And the people that I think are fighting to lose a battle are proving to be very resilient in being able to take this out and make it much longer than it should be. But one of the things I considered about you, and I think because I know you're pushing for the committees of safety, and that's a thing, but we're also fighting the fact that, let's face it, we have a very, very dumbed down public that's passive. And we need, if the people are truly going to be the sovereigns and run the company, we need more people to step up and to fight back. And one of the ways I think that you could possibly do it is, I know that that you have, I believe you said at one time you're going to write a letter to the commander, Northern Command.
Yep, we already did, but go ahead.
Okay, and I was thinking about that. I was thinking, well, first of all, for where I, you know, understanding combatant commands and everything like that, I don't know that that's necessarily the person, because the way this works, NORTHCOM would be considered a combatant command. At the end of the Cold War, there was a very significant reorganization of the military that went on. And they basically wanted to make the services much less powerful. And they did that because they took warfighting capabilities away from the services and gave them to these new creations they called combatant commands, and they put these four stars in charge of these combatant commands. But the combatant commands, although they're powerful in war fighting, they're subservient basically to the president. And so, you know, they're going to be order followers. But as we know, and this is, we don't, you know, you and I, where we're sitting now, we don't understand what the true status of devolution is. For one thing, nobody's going to admit to it. Trump's not going to tell you that. If this is true, there's an internal division within the U.S. government and U.S. military. So at any point, we don't know exactly who we're talking to, and if they're even knowledgeable, read into that portion, because this whole devolution thing seems to be a secret in many regards. But one of the things I know they're going to happen is a lot of this is going to be run by the rules of armed conflict and the law of war. So we have to figure that the staff judge advocates are going to play a very prominent role in this. And I know we've heard things about secret tribunals and so forth. There's no way for us to know that if they have taken place. They're somewhat suspect to me, because I would think that you would want, and everything we know is that they want these things to happen in a legal process above board. So I think it's somewhat dubious that there would be secret tribunals. Perhaps they have happened. I don't know. But one of the things that Liberty Alliance could do, and because I know that you have worked with your own grand jury there in New York, because I think you should write a letter to Trump probably to the Army Staff Judge Advocate and some others, and say that, hey, listen, we would like to offer our services, because I read just the other day the Army's manual on devolution, and the Army says that that devolution does not suspend the Constitution. It says that the Army, United States Army, will still work under the Constitution. So the rules of the Constitution, at least the spirit of it, is something that if we are in a devolved state, that those government people should be operating under. And particularly the staff judge advocate, if they have a lot of sealed indictments and things to work through, and by the way, even common citizens at this point, how would you address grievances to your citizens, of things that have been done to you? For example, COVID. If we are a devolved state and we are a captured country, then some of the things we've seen our own government do are violations of the law of armed conflict, and those are crimes. How would we get those aired, and who's gonna hear them? So I think you should offer to work with our states and our counties should work with the caretaker government, the staff judge advocate, to do common law courts and to work out and see if there's a legal mechanism to be able to do that. And it would actually have some utility for the military justice system, because obviously they are not staffed to handle large caseload. They're staffed to handle military members only. And perhaps they could offer justice. And I'm not sure, because obviously you would have to dig into the Constitution and the statutes and laws and the authorities and laws and orders for devolution itself and see if you can mesh those together. But would you actually consider reaching out to some of these people and say, listen, we're supposed to still, the Constitution is, according to the own manuals that the government's operating for devolution, is that the Constitution still is in effect.
Okay. Can you hear me, by the way?
Yeah, I got you.
Okay. Well, let me go back a little bit and try to cover all the bases that you brought up. Of course, a building committees of safety, that is the key. I wish we could have been further along on that. I don't know, by starting earlier might have made us further along by that. I don't think the people that are waking up would be serious enough early on. I think now they are serious. The problem is trying to get to millions of people, and out of millions of people, maybe pull 100,000 people, which would escalate this whole system extremely fast. Within 6 months, we can have committees of safety in every county with anywhere from 15 to 20 members at the point of connecting with their sheriff and then growing very quickly once they start to do certain things. I mean, they will grow in leaps and bounds very quickly. And especially this problem with the woke movement and the sexualizing of our children and the realization of the demoralizing of our children for at least two generations within our schools. And whereas they've removed, I don't even know if they do the Pledge of Allegiance anymore, and they teach them really, socialism, Marxism, pick your pick. They teach them anything but the common law, but the process that we have, what our republic is all about. So that's one thing, and we are moving through that. And if we can get some, by the way, someone's talking in the background. If we can get out there and get some money, and that's what we're looking for. And I think we're approaching that right now. We're going after about four different organizations that I've listed out, and there's probably a lot more than that. Organizations that actually give money, organizations that I do know are patriots. They're aware of the problems, and I think when we approach them, I think they'll see the wisdom of what we've done, and they'll see the track record of what we've done, what we've performed, where we're at, the education we put together, and all the different courses, and the fact that we really dug down deep into history to find out how things worked and who our founding fathers really are, and how they formed this republic, and that we are one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all, which is exactly what I used to pledge every day of my life, at least, you know, at least 5 days a week when you go to school alone. So that's one thing we're doing. We also formed the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, which is a standing, which is a grand jury that's in session now. It's been in session for quite a few years now, since 2016, I believe, Yeah, 2016, I believe, we went into session. And in order to create that, I don't know how familiar you are with what we're at, how we've done that, but just generally putting it out there anyway for people who don't know. We went to every county in America. Now, I wouldn't say that we physically went to every county. We might have done two or three counties at a time, collectively, in a central location, in order to get through the United States. There are certain counties that, of course, that don't have many people living in it at all, very rural. So, you know, if we got any information out to them, the few people here or there, then they would come to other counties. But we went to just about every county, say about 3,000 counties out of 3,120 or so counties, I forget the number. We didn't do it personally, in the sense myself and Gerard or a few other people. We did New York, and we've been to every county in New York, and we've been to every county in New York on numerous occasions since 2009 or 2010. And because we were doing other things before that, building, working the committee man process and working through the courts and trying, you know, a lot of different things. But in any event, we had numerous other people across the nation that were doing the work also at the same time. So we did organize and form committees, not committees of safety, but groups of people to agree that they need to come together and form a unified grand jury within their state. And we have formed 50 unified state common law grand juries. And then those 50 state uniform common law grand juries, unified common law grand juries, came together and we established the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury. So we have thousands of people involved in that. We have over 10,000 members. I'm not even sure we're in membership now. I think the last time I looked, it was 10-7, somewhere around there. You can look on the right-hand side of our website to find that out. But anyway, we then, whenever we do pull the grand jury together, we send a letter out. We have 10,779 members. And again, we have constituted all the counties in America, which means we've went and spoke to the people there. Small groups, of course, usually. We put the word out, put in newspapers, various other things, and whoever came, tell them what we're doing, and they participated or not. In most cases, it was unanimous. You always have a few problems, but it doesn't matter, you know, here or there. But, you know, you can have 100 people come together and one person say, yay, well, that's what common law is about, and that's what the republic is about, to protect the one from the mob. So it doesn't really matter. But we were very successful in this. So we've come together, and we've done quite a few indictments, a lot of stuff. If you come under the federal court here, let me see here, come under the federal court here, cases, you'll find the action we have against the judiciary, and we list out in here all of the different cases. We've done lots of indictments. We've done numerous habeas corpuses. We've went after a lot of judges. We've indicted a lot of judges, federal judges, state judges. And then we opened up a case up in New York, Northern District, and we opened it up for the sole purpose of using it as a depository, a place to put our paperwork. And so we started filing our papers up there. And now they may have closed it down, but they haven't done it officially. They never told us anything. And the last time we sent papers, they still accepted it. They didn't return it. And they never returned any of our papers. We also use our website as a depository. So every place we file the paper, we also have a copy up here on the website. We also send copies to the Attorney General. First it was Sessions, and then it was Barr. And when that administration ended, when Trump's administration ended, we stopped sending it because we knew it was worthless, so we didn't send them there no more. So we have a record. We put this before the United States Supreme Court, which is the paperwork we've done where we've been blocked on that on two occasions. There's one individual that's a doorkeeper and keeps blocking our paperwork. And so the reason why we went to the National Guard, but we also went to the militia, I mean, we went to NORTHCOM, but we also went to the militia, the National Guard. So we notified both of them as the enforcement. And we sent our papers in, again, twice to the United States Supreme Court, individually and collectively. each one individually and collectively. One of the things we do know is that something's going on up there at the Supreme Court, because they've been making some great, great decisions lately. Last year, they did some two major decisions, and this year, recently, they did a great decision. And these are things you'd never think would take place. You know, the reversal of Roe versus Wade, for instance, the gun situation where, you know, you can't force a person to, you know, have a license to have a gun. You know, we have the right of the first, the Second Amendment, and then the third one. There was one recent. I'm forgetting what that one is right now, but it was a very powerful case also. So something's going on up there. We saw the Brunson case. The Brunsons went in, and they filed the case, and we discovered through back channels, so to speak, I mean, it's out there anyway, that what they did is they went to NORCOM and used NORCOM as an enforcement. And the story is, how true this is, I don't have 100% on this, you know, but this is the story. It feels pretty solid to me, but it is what it is. And that the reason why the Supreme Court has taken back the case and is considering it is because of the pressure put upon them by NORCOM. So that's one of the reasons why we decided to try to use NORCOM as an enforcement. And then we thought, well, okay, let's use the National Guard too. So we did the militia also. And we copied them both. And we copied the highest ranks there. And we put on a paperwork. And you get a copy of all that if you go to, right on our front page alone, just go to the front page and you come down and you'll see, let's see, where is it? Click here to read the writ mandamus to the United States Supreme Court filed on February 2nd, 2023. And again, we filed it twice and it was returned twice. So I was thinking of a couple of things, you know, I'm still puzzling through, and someone had brought up JAG to me, Judge Advocate General, which is what you just brought up. And so that's probably the next process we're going to use. And even though we're going to use Judge Advocate General, I think we're still going to also copy at the same time NORCOM and Brunson and the National Guard. And we're going to bring the whole thing up to date and file all the papers together so that all of these three different entities understand and know the process we went through and also what the results was. As a matter of fact, the individual who blocked us from the first time around, and I'm beside myself, really, because we're reporting a subversion against the United States of America at its highest level, and we're very clear with that. And the law requires that if someone is aware of subversion, treason, and they have to report it immediately to some judge or the president or a governor, which is sort of a president of a state anyway, but you have to report it, and that's the law. And if you don't, you're part and parcel with the with that problem, because you hit it. You didn't do nothing about it. So you have a duty to do it. And so we use that kind of language, and we also use the language that they have to do something. And so we put it, and we made it much clearer the second time around to the clerk, and the clerk blocked it again. Then we sent the clerk a quo warranto. I don't know if you're familiar with a quo warranto, but it's, you know, to give us their credentials and so cause. They got 10 days, and they have to give us their bonds, their oath, and their financials. And they failed to do that, so they defaulted on that. So we've been puzzling the next step. So JAG is the next step I think we're going to go with. I also thought, and we may do this at the same time, you see, we need to get the papers before the judges, the nine judges up there on the Hill. And I was thinking about it. I was looking in to see how that structure works up there and who their clerks were. And I can get the names of their clerks. They have, all these judges have numerous clerks, at least three maybe, and I'm sure maybe even more than that, but at least three clerks. And I'm trying to discover, well, which clerk would I want to... I want to bypass the main clerk, which receives the paperwork, and I want to send information or paper... I want to send the paperwork directly to a clerk of each one of the judges. Maybe I'll do all three or four, or how many they have, each one. But again, this comes to money now, so we have to be concerned with money, too, because there's a lot of paperwork to be made and a lot of mailing to be done. But in any event, this is kind of my next thinking, is to send the paperwork directly to all these clerks, so three or four for each, or at least one anyway, to each one of the nine justices up there. Once the paperwork is before them, now they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. As long as we can prove that they got the paperwork, they've been fully informed on the treason, and what are you going to do about it? Now, there's a couple of things, and also JAG, and we may try JAG first because we could do that a lot quicker, and meanwhile we can be working on the other situation going to the judges if JAG fails. But the key thing is to get it before the judges. Now, as far as Q is concerned, or shall I say devolution, I think Q is a major part of this whole thing, and pretty much what Q has been talking about over the years really has been all about what's happening this year and potentially next year. I'm not sure of the timing. I don't know that anyone knows anything about the timing of this thing and what it's going to take or where it's going to go. But there's a couple of things we do know. If devolution isn't real, which I can say I'm 99.99%. I mean, I want to say 100%, but, you know, I'll just say 99.999%. Maybe I will move to 100%. I'm 100% sure that it's real. And why do I say that? Well, first of all, what Q has said over the past years, and he's been silent for a couple of years now, but it all, you know, a couple of times Q said, and Q is a group of people, and Q identifies also with the military as much as the word devolution applies with the military. And Q goes back, I believe, even back to the days of Lincoln, and probably even before that, but back to Lincoln. And so Q was somewhat involved back then. And Q today, I think, is really driven, I'm guessing on this, by special forces particularly.
If I can offer a suggestion for that.
Yeah, let me just finish because I'm almost done, and then you can talk some more, okay? But anyway, so Q, that's one thing. But here's another thing. You know, I've been a student of the Bible for a very long time, and I'm a 100% true believer in the Word of God. And, you know, when things go wrong, it's because we misunderstood. And, you know, we nobody knows everything. And but there are certain things that is very clear in the Bible to me. And I've studied heavily since 1991, I believe it was, or 92, is when I started to dig deep into, you know, prophecy as far as Revelation is concerned. And that takes you back through the entire book, because the book of Revelations really is a synopsis of the entire Bible, ultimately. And it's all looking for keywords and key phrases and going back to see how God used it and looking into the prophetic books and many, many things. I mean, it's really, again, the synopsis of the entire Bible. And going through that and understanding the judgments that God's going to place upon this world, there's a judgment that takes place, and you can read about it in Isaiah 14. And before the Lord comes, God is going to judge nations. And through that judging nations, he judges Leviathan. And that brings us right to where we're at today. We have nations that are going to be judged. And Leviathan, the great beast, which is ultimately the kingdom of Satan in its highest power, which I would perceive would be the New World Order. And this is pretty harmonious to me anyway. But I don't want to get into looking into the Bible as far as the prophetic side that I'll save for Bible studies if I get back into that again. But the bottom line is, for me, Isaiah 14 seals this whole thing, because when I look at to see what's really going on and to understand who Leviathan is and what Leviathan represents, that it's the kingdom of Satan at its highest point, and we wrestle we wrestle against principalities and spiritual wickedness in high places. Okay, that's what we're up against. And that, of course, brings us into the spiritual realms, to the churches, and we can see what's going on there. But it also takes us into the political realms of the whole world, because these people are Satanists. These people do the most evil things you can't even imagine. I mean, when you hear, who would even think of the things that they do? And the evil that they put upon people, particularly children and newborn babies, it's unmentionable. It's unbelievable. But that's how evil we're dealing against. So with all that collectively, my point is this, is I'm very confident. But I will say one thing. If devolution isn't real, and if Q is just a fantasy in the minds of the people, and if that is the facts, we're in big trouble. Because there's no way we can get out of this. And that, I guess, is really the bottom line of what I'm trying to say.
I'm very familiar from this, from much more than you know, because I know and I've talked to some of the names that that you're going to hear in the press and so forth. And my suggestion would be, contact the staff judge advocates, but you need to get specific. And I would.
Let me ask you a question. You said two individuals on the JAG.
You need to go, because every service, the Marine Corps, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, they're all going to have their own separate staff judge advocates, and of course, it'll be one of the general staff.
You're enlightening me on this one. Go ahead, okay.
And the same thing, all of the combatant commands will also have their staff judge advocates. And if NORTHCOM, if you believe that there's a channel there, I would want to try to directly contact that staff judge advocate. And when you're talking about continuity government, something I'm familiar with, because when I was on the joint staff, we ran the continuity government program because we were training to send our people to remote locations, and that could be anything from a national disaster to this. And when you talk about the type of devolution, because I think devolution did take place of some sort, because the events of January 6th cannot be explained any other way. You had Christopher Miller just before the transition setting up those fences and stationing National Guard troops around around the Capitol and other government buildings. And then the National Guard, which there were a fair number of them in there, when Biden's motorcade came back, they turned their backs on him. That is not done. You don't do that. Also, I personally, this is my opinion, I think Biden's dead, at least the original one. And the reason was because they gave him a funeral salute when he went on January 6th, when he went to Arlington Cemetery. Mm-hmm. If it was a presidential 21-gun salute, there would have been a battery of four guns, and they would have fired in a very rapid succession. Instead, they didn't fire 21 guns. And what they did there on that day was a funeral salute. So I think that was saying that, that was his funeral. And there were, we could go on with a number of other things that something strange really did happen. Because I looked
through, and I am familiar with all of the things you mentioned, and the turning of the backs and the funeral thing and everything. So I kind of agree with you, and it does sort of give it more power to the probability. But go ahead, continue.
I would branch out and because the way the continuity government thing is going to work, if there's a classified program, and I know there are, and because there can be classified programs that people in the government are never even going to know about, because if there are hand selected things, I could tell you about things that in the Pentagon where there were like three people that got something. It would come to me. The only reason I would have it is because, if this gets disseminated to me, there are three specific people that need to get this, and nobody else. And so there could be one Supreme Court justice that's read into devolution and cooperating with the team, and the other justices don't even know.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question. Maybe you and me could talk, on the phones. We're kind of coming to the end of this tonight's program, and I do have to leave in a few minutes, but I'd like to continue this conversation and get some more information and insight on this, and maybe if you can think of certain judge advocates in the different, militaries, as far as, the Marines, the Army, and Navy, and so on, Air Force, or whatever, maybe if you can think of lists or addresses or anything, maybe you can give us that information and insight. But you want to get on the phones maybe during the week and talk some more?
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
I'll ask you to do is this. Send an email to Jan, at nationallibertyalliance.org, okay? And just give him your name, and he's listening in. Give him your name and your phone number, and tell him, if he's listening in, he'll know we had this conversation at the end of the night concerning JAG and other things. And then he'll give me a call, give me that information, and then I'll call you in the next couple of days. I have, I may be able to call you tomorrow if you get the information. And I know Wednesday for me is an extremely busy day. But sometime this week I'd like to talk some more and get some info, because you're enlightening me on things, knowledge that I think I need in order to try to pursue get my papers somewhere. And the key to me is to get it before the United States Supreme Court, because I believe if I can get it before the justices, I think they're going to do the right thing. You know, it is possible that even with the interference that we've had with preventing the papers from going through, that they still might have gotten it through if the NORCOM and the National Guard, which we have heard was really is what pushed the Brenson case, at least to be seen by the United States Supreme Court, and all these different decisions being made, you know, maybe it's too premature for our case to get before them and for it to be really put out into the public on a heavy end, because the case that we brought and put together, I don't know if you had a chance to read it, but you can read it. It's on our front page. I don't know if you're looking at...
I've read the Brenson case, and I looked over the case that you put there before.
Okay, so all those memorandums, those points, and as a matter of fact, I missed a few points, and I'd like to add a few more points to that. But it really lays out how destructive they were to our judicial system, to our court system, and how they destroyed and think that they can, take away the common law to nullify it and bring it and replace it by rule into our court system, civil law. So anyway, I'd like to talk some more with you.
Okay. Yeah, you bet. I'd be happy to.
All right, and if I don't, if I give you a call and I miss you, I'll leave a message. Get back to me when you can. And, I don't have an answering machine, but I see every call that goes through, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can if I miss your call.
Okay. You bet.
All right. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate
it.
Okay.
Your time. All right. Good night.
Okay. Good night. All right. We got a lot of other people still in the queue, but it's time to go. I'm sorry to get to you. We had some good conversations today, some important ones, and we'll talk next week. And for those coming to Saturday, we'll see you Saturday at the next lesson. Thanks, everyone, for coming. Woodwin, we'll see you next Monday. Good night.